You're listening to 9 Plus, a research podcast from SETU Ireland. Welcome to another episode of 9 Plus. I'm your host, Rob O'Connor, from the Southeast Technological University of Ireland. In this episode, I'm speaking with a couple of postgraduate students about their work, but also their situation. My guests are Steve Daly and Nicola Briggs, who both returned to education as mature students. They caught the bug and they've now ploughed on into PhD work. Sometimes in various media outlets, especially around Leaving Cert time, there's a certain path presented, Leaving Cert College and then beyond. And the story of somebody in their 40s launching into an academic career is rarely heard. And here we have two of them. Both Nicola and Steve are great examples of how there's numerous paths into education for people who are interested. And if somebody is keen to take it further, there's always an avenue you can go down. Steve and Nicola are both engaging guests, and I'd hope you'll enjoy hearing their stories. There's oodles of enthusiasm coming off both of them, and it's not difficult to understand why. They're involved in physical activity research that has the potential to help a lot of real people. And who wouldn't be enthusiastic about that? So, without any further preamble, we'll have Nicola and Steve introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Steve Daly. I'm a second-year PhD student in SETU Waterford.
Hi, my name is Nicola Briggs. I am a first-year PhD student in SETU Waterford.
Well, you're very welcome into the studio, the pair of you. I want to ask you to describe the work that you're doing at the moment or the area that you're in so we can kind of set the scene. And then we'll find out how you got there. Does that sound okay? So, sure, Nicola, we'll start with yourself. So you're at the very, very beginning of this journey,
aren't
you?
Yeah, very beginning. Yeah, started in September. So I'm in the Department of Sports and Exercise Science. My background in health promotion, and my focus really is on physical activity and health. So I am using implementation science, which is real world science, to measure the effectiveness of the Ireland Lights Up initiative that's run in the clubs in the winter by the GAA, in terms of how it's implemented across the club network, the impact on physical and mental health. We're going to do a little bit of social return and investment work on it, and ultimately hoping to develop a blueprint to roll out to sporting NGOs across Ireland and maybe internationally.
Okay, so can you describe what Ireland Lights Up is? I don't really know what that is. What is it?
Yeah, so Ireland Lights Up is an initiative that's run from January to March or to the end of February with the GAA. It's run in conjunction with Operation Transformation. So it kicks off the same week as Operation Transformation, and then it runs for about 7 weeks. Basically, the GAA allow their club network to open up their pitches, a lot of which have walking tracks. They put their floodlights on and they welcome anyone from the community to come in and walk around the tracks. Of any age, they don't have to be club members. It's just anyone who wants to come in and use the facilities. Often there's a little bit of tea and cake involved as well, a bit of social connection. But it's really to get people out walking in the dark winter nights when they don't have anything else to do, and possibly the roads, especially in rural areas, it's not safe for people to walk, so they can use the facilities of the GAA clubs.
Okay, and I'm imagining that the benefits of this is that the GAA are everywhere, you know, they're nationwide, and every parish has a club or close to that anyway. Yeah. And again, the idea is that even if you're in a rural area where you don't have footpaths, you may not have light, somebody can walk or a group of people can walk in a safe environment. Is that kind of the main thing behind it?
That's it in a nutshell.
Okay,
yeah.
Right, okay. Okay, we'll come back to that then in a moment and find out how you got there. Steve, You're working in something with football, is it?
I am, yeah. My PhD is a feasibility study for scale-up of a social initiative which is called Football Cooperative. Okay. So basically, I suppose the elevator pitch is that football cooperatives run by men for men. It's important that men look after their health because generally they tend not to. Men would have lower life expectancy, they have poor health outcomes than their female counterparts, and most of this is down to modifiable factors. So about 70% of health is down to modifiable factors. However, men are not really looking after their health as well as they should be. This is often down to gendered norms and gendered practice and that. Mm. So one of the hooks that can reach men is football, and particular interventions, a particular way interventions are run, reach men. So one of those would be football. It's by men, it's for the men, it's run very much with men in mind. It's physical activity above a nutritional element. And I suppose more importantly for the guys, it's very much about them and about their experience. So they're not prescribing to a particular program or that, and they're just there for the competitive game of football, and we're looking at the benefits they get. We're also using what's called an SROI, a social return on investment methodology. So rather than going in and looking at a particular question such as, well, what physical benefit are the participants getting? We go in and we identify who the stakeholders are. So in this case, it's the participants themselves, their significant others, the guys who run the league, and then the community partners who provide the venue. And then we ask them about their experiences and the impact of those experiences, both positive and negative. So rather than specifically, as I say, going in and looking at, what are they physically getting out of it? We're asking them, okay, what do you get out?
Okay.
So the guys have described that they get a physical benefit, a mental health benefit, and a social benefit as well.
And what was the name of that programme again?
So it's called Football Cooperative.
Football Cooperative. And is this, again, now I'm ignorant about this, is this a thing that's based purely in Waterford? Is it a national thing? Is it a regional thing? Where
so,
is it?
So Football Cooperative started in 2017. Its founder member had moved to North County, Dublin, and he was stationed there to work. And he went out on a Wednesday night, had a look around the place he was, wandered into a pub. There was horse racing on one channel and Champions League on the other, and he felt, God, is this what I'm going to be doing when I'm here? So using social media platforms, he kind of went looking for similar guys who were looking for a game of football, found a venue. They arranged a meetup. They had a kind of a 5 or 6 a-side game, and that kind of increased over time. And now they've got over 1,000 participants, members who play over 2 sites. So I suppose my work is, it's a feasibility study for scale up. So what we're looking to do is see how feasible it is to scale this up around the country. And using the SROI methodology, it's very much about the people who participate there as experience. We're not basing this on fiscal incentives, or we're not looking to see, well, what money is this going to make? We're looking for what's called the social return. What do the participants get? What do the people around them get out of it? And put a financial value on that.
And is there any particular age that this is targeted at? I'm assuming it's not targeted at like 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds. Or is it? Maybe it is.
It's open to all. The data from the Foresight has shown that the average age of participants is about 37 years of age.
Okay, yeah.
So it's kind of guys who are possibly not able to commit to playing even in junior level at GAA or soccer. They have young families, most of them. They've got young kids. So they want that competitive game, but they're not able to commit to training 2 or 3 nights a week. So what this offers them is a pay-as-you-play system whereby they get a notification on WhatsApp, thumbs up and thumbs down to whether they're available. Then they can pay by Revolut, and then they just turn up on the night with their boots. The teams are picked, balls are there, goals are set up. And the guys who coordinate, the volunteers, do I suppose, the donkey work in that. The teams are picked based on guys' fitness and their ability to play.
Okay, so you're not putting, you know, Ronaldo next to me.
Yeah.
Or whatever, yeah.
So they're, I suppose, the two most important criteria. And then they judge it on positions people like to play in and their friends. So it might be a case where I have a preference to play on the same team as Nicola, or I might kind of go, well, I want to play on the opposite team. And as the guys describe themselves, the volunteers will tell you that if a game finishes 4-all, they've done their job.
Okay, yeah.
And then they publish little match reports for the guys, you know, and who scored and who did well and that kind of thing. So, and the guys, they don't have to commit to turn up every week. They can turn up when it suits them. So guys might play 8 weeks in a row and then not be there for 4 weeks, but know that their place is not gone, or well, somebody else is playing now. So it's very much a casual commitment.
So would this kind of be an extension of men's sheds, or am I being maybe I'm being silly?
It could be viewed in a similar fashion as the men's sheds in that
the same ball, same area, rough.
In that it's geared up, it's gender sensitized for men. So what we know about reaching men is that men like to have that they don't like to be out of a healthcare setting. So if something is on in a healthcare setting, it's a no-no for men. So they want it community based. So again, men's sheds and Football Cooperative have that. They want an emphasis, I suppose, on physical activity, on doing rather than learning. So again, football and men's sheds is all about the practice of that. They want peer support. So they want guys like them there. I know my own experiences of doing things to help my own health and that. I'm in a gym with someone who's half my age and half my body mass, and they're telling me what I should do and, you know, how I should be going. And it can be a little bit, I suppose it can be appear condescending. But when you have the right models, so if I'm looking to a guy who's around my age and he's telling me, look, I started playing last year and, you know, I lost a bit of weight and, you know, I feel a lot fitter and I'm able to play with the kids, that's a nicer message for me to hear than, you know, you need to do X amount of burpees and then you'll be doing this and do that. So I suppose there's an age element thing to it. The men's sheds tends to be a slightly older age cohort, so okay, around the late 50s, 60s, so I suppose pre-retirement, whereas football cooperative, it's still a chance for guys to show they can still go and nutmeg a guy half their age, you know, and they still have that ability to you know, make a beautiful cross. When we interviewed the participants, one guy spoke about it was an area for artistic expression for him. He could go out and express himself on the pitch with a beautiful pass or reading the game or something like that. And, you know, and that to me was brilliant. I spoke to one guy who, just before we started collecting our data, it was at the eve of the return to play at the end of COVID. And the football cooperative ran a kind of lottery to see who would play the first night. And he was one of the lucky guys. And he was a CEO of a company that did a lot of employees. They'd come through COVID pandemic, a huge amount of stress. And we'd finished the interview and I just asked him casually, I said, are you looking forward to tomorrow? And he said, Stevie, he said, I'm going to go to bed tonight and I'm going to dream about scoring goals. And tomorrow I'm going to go and score them. And I mean, I thought that was wonderful. He was like a teenager before the cup final, you know, or like a young child. He was going to go to bed and dream about scoring goals in football cooperative the following night. And I suppose, you know, that for me was a lovely story to hear. And I suppose it's why I'm passionate about this particular project as well.
So Nicola, with the Ireland Lights Up initiative, so if you've only started in September and if this runs from January, you obviously haven't had that experience of working with the participants on the ground or the people on the ground. Are you nervous about it? Because that's not fair, but we were talking before we came in here and we were talking about teaching because you're both doing a bit of teaching at undergraduate level. And we're all saying, like, the bit when you're actually in the room is the easy part. The hard part is all the prep. So I'm assuming for you, the bit from January to March, if you're out in the pitch walking around or talking to people, that's probably the easy part. The hard part is the prep. Now, you're nodding, okay? So what kind of prep work are you doing for the upcoming iteration of Ireland Lights Up?
Yeah, it's lovely listening to Steve. You can tell he's further on in his journey than I am because he's like so enthusiastic about it. But I am very fortunate in that I got to be involved in formative research, which led into this PhD. So in fourth year, I was asked, would I be interested in volunteering as a student to do some interviews and to do some data collection around 10 clubs that were chosen. And I said yes, I would love to do it. So I got to go out and visit clubs. I also got to interview people about their experiences with Ireland Lights Up, and it was such a positive experience. I mean, it's an initiative that, just when people talk about it, they're really positive about it, not just from the physical side of things, but from the social connection side of things. And we visited some clubs in Waterford and you just get chatting to people as you're walking around. And, you know, there was people there that had older man had lost his wife the year before, and he came up, did the walking with Ireland Lights Up. He came up at other times and it was like a lifeline for him. Other people that made new friendships throughout the Ireland Lights Up, that, you know, someone spotted them having a cup of coffee after the Ireland Lights Up finished and they didn't know each other before that. So the social connection side of things really came through. So I think because I was part of that formative research, I'm not so nervous about going into the actual data collection in January. And I have been involved in going up to Croke Park. I was there on Saturday at the GAA Health and Wellbeing Conference, just chatting to people about their experiences, about how it runs in their clubs and things like that. It's a very welcoming, friendly part of the organisation. the club leaders are so proud of their clubs. They really want to talk about it. They're so proud of what the things that they can do. So yes, there's obviously I'm going through ethics and doing all my questionnaires and all that side of things, kind of hitting the ground running with that in order to be able to do data collection in January. But I'm actually really excited about getting out there, because that for me is the joy of research, is actually being privileged enough to hear people's stories and for them to trust you enough to talk to you about what's going on in their lives and how whatever you're researching is benefiting them or how it could benefit them more. It's a real privilege and I'm really excited about that.
So who's your supervision team here?
So my PI is Dr. Ashley McGrath, and my co-supervisor is Dr. Barry Lamb. And then I also have two other very experienced co-supervisors, Professor Niamh Murphy and Dr. Noel Richardson, who is in SETU in Carlow. So I have a team of four. I'm in extremely good hands.
Yeah, they've nearly all featured on this podcast, except for Barry Lamb, actually. We must get him in at some stage. And Steve, with yourself, who's your supervision team?
So Paula Carroll and Tom Egan are my primary supervisors, and I also have Professor Michael Harrison and Dr. Noel Richardson as well. Okay. So my PhD is part of a larger project. So there's a whole football cooperative project. So I'm feasibility. There's another PhD student who's implementation, and we've a third master student who's just started, who's going to be examining, I suppose, the physical impact of the football cooperative. That may become a PhD in future.
Yeah, I mean, we often hear with research about impact, you know, measuring impact, and often it's a score based on a journal or something like that, which is obviously, look, that's important. That's academic currency, and I understand that. But what you're talking about here is you're talking about dealing with actual real people, and it might have a material effect on their life or their quality of life. And again, I know, what was it you said? SOI, was it?
Social Return on Investment, SROI.
SROI, yeah. I love that. I must put that in my acronym bank.
Yes.
So that's, you're both kind of working in the same area. And I believe, am I right saying, Steve, that you kind of convinced Nicola to do this, was it?
Well, I won't say convinced her to do this, but...
Not the podcast. I mean, well, you did convince her to do the podcast. But I mean, I would say encourage her, say, Nicola, you know, if you want to do this PhD, there's scope there. Am I right about that or not?
I believe I spoke a few years ago to prospective incoming students in what was WIT at the time, and I felt my own experience as a mature student had been so helpful and beneficial to me that it was something I was happy to do and actually sought to seek out to do. So when the mature student open days were on, I was on to Student Life and Learning. Would you like me to talk? Mm-hmm. And I believe Nicola was at one of those talks, and I must have said something right. So I think that was maybe the final straw that broke her will and said, okay, well, look, I need to go back and do this. I'm missing out on something, perhaps.
I love your use of positive language. is that true, Nicola? Do you remember it that way?
I do. I remember it. And actually, I had the privilege of being talking at the Mature Open Day last year, and Steve was doing his pitches PhD, okay. And obviously I was coming up to graduating, but I came back. I knew I was going to be made redundant from my job.
So this is when this is you coming in as an undergrad.
Okay, yeah,
because that's the thing, I suppose, which we haven't established, is that you're both mature students now. The official, I think, mature student is somebody who's over 23 at undergrad. I think it's 23. I lose track of it.
Yeah, it's 23. I don't feel like I'm 23 yet.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I remember the day my dad retired. He was 64. And I called over to him because it was his birthday, and I said, how do you feel? He said you don't understand it, in my head I'm still 21. Mm-hmm. And I look in the mirror and I see an old man. Now you're not 65, none of you. Yeah. But I understand this kind of idea about mental age and physical age. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So you're both mature students, as in you're both over 23 when you came back into education. So sorry, Nicola, I interrupted you there, because I think your story is replicated all across the country. And I think it's important that people hear it, because you don't have to be 18 coming into college. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a path for everyone. So sorry.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I didn't go to college when I left school. I went to technical college. Yeah. So I did a 2-year course, and then I worked and travelled and got married and had babies. And in my late 30s, I was being made redundant. And I had wanted to come back to university for years and just thought, how can I do it? Mm. And actually, it was my husband said, why don't you go back to college. And I was like, how can I go back to college? I have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old. I need to work. We need the money. I just can't do it. Yeah. So he said, look, go to the open day and just try it out. So I signed up for the WIT Mature Students Open Day. And yes, they had, at the end of the day, they had a panel. There was a lady from computer science, or there was a lady from criminology, I think. And there was Steve from psychology. And
David Conway.
I don't remember him.
Yeah, David, because David Conway was very influential in me staying in college.
Okay, right. So we'll put a mark on that. We'll come back to it.
They spoke about their experiences, and I was just like, it was so inspiring. The whole day was inspiring. I came out like absolutely walking on clouds. I went home to my husband. I was like, I really want to go back. Like, I just loved it. And listening to the panel talking about their experiences, they all had kids, I think. Steve's kids are similar-ish ages to mine. Mm. And I thought, well, you know, if they can do it, like, I can do this. So I applied, and then I started the September 2019. So I was in college throughout COVID, which is a bit of an interesting experience. But then obviously I graduated and then straight into my PhD. I love it here, so I don't want to leave.
Yeah, this place is like the mafia in Godfather Part 3. It's just when you think you're out, they pull you back in. Okay, so you had a COVID experience, which is which never happened, and we're not going to talk
Absolutely.
About that. But the... You see, you've come back in as a mature student, but you've now decided to carry on with this through to postgraduate level. And I do find that quite interesting, you know, because if you had, let's say you had come into college when you were 18 or you know, thereabouts, say you finished secondary school and you went straight in. Do you think you would have enjoyed it as much?
Look, it's very hard to answer that because you're a different type of person, aren't you? Because I'm coming into college with all the life experience that I have and the things that I have done and the things that have happened to me. But I can, the only way I can answer that is when I was the only mature student in my year. And when I look at the other students who I loved, and they were brilliant and I got on really well with them. But they're kind of... There's a rounding out of your experience and of your understanding of things, particularly in the field that I'm in, which is public health and health promotion, that I don't think you can actually have when you're 18 or 19, because you have come straight from school into university. You just can't have a deep understanding of that. And coming back in as a mature student and as a parent and all the other things that you experience along the way, you can have a much... rounded out view and a much deeper understanding of things that affects people's health, their mental health. You've lived through some of those. And I suppose the other thing is as well, I've always been a bit of a nerd. I'll be perfectly honest about that. Like, my kids call me a nerd. I love reading books. I am a bit of a nerd, and I'm totally fine with it. But when you come back to university, you, as a mature student, you come back because you really want to be there. And so you have that fire in your belly, you have that motivation that sometimes younger ones don't have, because they maybe are going to college because their parents expect them to go to college. Or they're so young, they don't even know what they want to do. They pick a course. It might work for them, it might not work for them. The course that I did was the only course that I wanted to do. I had no interest in doing any of the course. I always knew I wanted to do public health and health promotion, even for years before I actually came back. And when I came back and I started studying it, I knew it was for me. I was passionate about it. I love it. So I had that added motivation, I think, that I probably wouldn't have had if I had come to college when I was 18 or 19. Mm. Your focus is different, isn't it?
And Steve, for yourself, what way have you come into this?
Kind of similar to Nicola a little bit. I was made redundant as well. Yeah. Within 6 months of becoming a parent for the second time, my wife was made redundant. Shortly after that, I was made redundant. So we were kind of in a recession and things were looking fairly bleak for us. I'd had some health issues as well. So I'd had to have several hernia operations. And after the last one, the surgeon said, he told me on the day, but of course, been on the drugs, I couldn't tell what he was saying. But he came back for an appointment out of 6 weeks and he said he couldn't keep doing the same operation. I'd had a triple hernia the last time. So he said, I needed a sedentary job. Okay. He said, you need an office job. And I said, I'm not qualified for a sedentary job. And he said, well, you know, maybe you need to think about that. So I did, and I applied for college. I did my Leaving Cert in 1992, so it was 25 years out of education.
You hadn't gone, you hadn't done anything, you had been working for that time.
I'd been working the whole time, I'd worked mainly in the service industry. I suppose I'd settled, I was running an off licence in town, and I was enjoying doing that. And I suppose always there was a thing in the back of my head going, you could have done more, or did you challenge yourself enough? And I'd read a lot around, and I was big into quizzes, and I liked the idea of being clever. And anytime there was education on offer, I went and sought it. Coming to college, I suppose, was totally new. I didn't know what to expect. And I was bricking it the first day I arrived for the registration. I literally knew no one there. Mm-hmm. I hadn't been to an open day. I tried to email the college and ask a few questions, and there didn't seem to be anyone there who could help me. And it wasn't through a lack of caring from the college. It just seemed to be my questions were falling between the cracks, and I felt, God, this wasn't for me. And I remember arriving on the open day, or not the open day, the registration day, and sitting down and been in a queue and sitting on a table. And I was very close to getting up and actually leaving. And I was going, I've made a mistake. There's no one like me here. Or I didn't fit in. And a guy called Davy Conway came over. So Davy was a mature student who was just finishing his degree, and he was working as a student ambassador that day. And he came over and he said, are you okay? And I said, yeah, you look lost. Do you know where you're going? And I knew he didn't mean physically.
Yeah.
It was a metaphor. And I said, I don't, Davy. Do you think you could help me? And he said, I'll do my very best. And since then, I suppose, myself and Davy, as an undergrad, we were very close. He was always a step ahead of me and offered me great advice. And I felt that was something I should really be giving back. So we started a mature student society as an undergrad. Mm. I started the club, the parents as student support. PASS, love, that's one for your
academic. There's another one, yeah.
The PASS group. So we would get together on a Mondays and have coffee and bitch about the lecturers and our classmates. But it was great for that social support. Mm. On completing my degree, I knew I wanted to do more. I'd gotten the bug and I wanted to go a little step further. And my degree was in psychology. And I suppose I was interested in psychology because from my lifetime of working in the service industry, I was interested to know why people were so amazing. Or other words beginning with A, perhaps.
Yeah. Okay, right.
If you can read between the lines on that.
Right. It's a metaphor.
Yeah. So I loved doing that, graduated, and I wanted more. And I was chatting with Ciara Losty one day about having her appendix out, as you do. Mm. And Ciara said, look, there's applied sport and exercise psychology, masters. I'll keep a place open for you. If you're interested, let me know. So I suppose I was really interested, and I'd learned to dream bigger than myself. So I suppose the ultimate job for me coming out of psychology would have been a sports psychologist with Liverpool. Yeah. I'm still waiting on that call. They don't kind of need one, I don't think, at the moment, but you never know.
Just go to Everton.
I just would hate that. That would be purgatory. Yeah. So I suppose that got me interested in doing sports psychology, and I really enjoyed doing the masters. That was my experience of being a postgrad, and it was on during COVID. I did really well, I thought. I ended up finishing top of my class. So that was a huge achievement for me in my lifetime. I don't ever felt that sense of achievement. And because of the encouragement of Ciara and of everyone else I'd met in, I'll say WIT, because that's what it was when I joined, everyone here nurtured and supported me, and everyone was very protective. All the lecturers I met, all the staff here, everyone was really supportive and encouragement, and not what I was expecting. And I suppose as a postgrad, I was able to give that back a little, but I still found the support was there. So support from Ciara suggested that I apply for a scholarship, because I was saying PhD is not for someone like me. I'd be very working class. None of my family have done third level education. The idea was you finish school and you got a job. Mm. And, you know, that was for other people. So doing a degree wasn't for people like me. Doing a master's wasn't for people like me. So I may as well, you know, go for the Holy Trinity and do a PhD as well, and really show these people who probably don't exist really. Mm. So I applied for a couple of scholarships. I only wanted to go to SETU. I wasn't interested in studying anywhere else. I suppose my family's commitments made that more likely, but the people I'd met, as I said, were so important, and I wanted to have that support and have that nurturing around me. So I applied for a few. I suppose I was really interested in football. I didn't know much about public health promotion, but going back to when I was made redundant at 42, I could see from my peers and my mates that they were all going through the same issues around that 2013 time when guys lost their job, they lost their sense of identity. I had friends who'd killed themselves.
Yeah.
I'd had friends who had their health had really deteriorated, their marriages had broken up. They'd gone through absolutely shocking times when their identity was tied up in who they were. And when they lost that,
Identity was tied up with their job.
Yeah, so I suppose I'd often allude to that with athletes now working as a sports psychologist when they transition out of sport. You know, what did they call Postman Pat when he retired? Pat, you know, but he's not the same person because we all know him as Postman Pat. So it was similar for my friends. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but I suppose that kind of got me interested in the area of public health and of men's health in particular. I'd be an advocate for women in sport, but I suppose with health promotion, I'm very much the target audience, and I'm aware of guys my age and around my age, their health is not good. They're not looking after it. They're the ones committing suicide. Mm-hmm. They're the ones been injured in accidents. They're the ones victims and perpetrators of the most assaults.
Mm.
They're the ones who have heart conditions that they're not looking after. They're the ones who are getting diabetes through ignorance and through a lack of caring about themselves. So these are the people I feel are really important to reach. And even within men, there's other subpopulations. So the data really shows that men who are educated to a lower level and in lower socioeconomic status and in more deprived areas are much more likely to die. I know within Ireland that the life expectancy of the least of the most affluent men is still lower than the average life expectancy of the most deprived women. So it's slightly older data. It might have changed during COVID, but that was very much the case that even the well-off men are doing worse than the least well-off women. So men really need to wake up about their own health, and we need to break those social norms and that. So I suppose this PhD is something I'm passionate about, and it gives it a chance to reach men at the level they're at and where they're at to hopefully affect the change. So I suppose it's bigger. The PhD is bigger than me.
Mm. So I don't want to make it seem like there's some sort of value judgment or elitism about, oh, you must be in the academy to be a worthy person, because that's obviously not true. Like, I'm not suggesting that, but it was interesting to hear how you ended up in this kind of academic role that may not necessarily have been there 20 years ago, you know. So I that's why I was getting at that, and I wasn't trying to make it seem like anything was you're better if you do this or you're worse if you do that. That's not a value judgment at all.
I couldn't have done what I'm doing now when I was younger. I wouldn't have been able to. It's interesting, there's a lady called Diane Nyad, I don't know if you've ever heard of her.
No.
But she swam from Cuba to Key West in Florida, so it's 110 miles of ocean current, Pacific water, with sharks and jellyfish and storms and surges and eddies and currents and all this. And she attempted, she was an Olympic swimmer. She'd won medals swimming in the Olympics for America. And she attempted to do this at 28 and didn't do it. And she did it when she was 60.
Okay.
And didn't do it. And she tried again at 61. And in total, she made five attempts. And at 64 years of age, I think, on her fifth attempt, she swam it. So it was very little to do with her body or her physical abilities or her age. It was all to do with her mind.
Mm. Well, that was going to be my next thing about how the life experience feeds into your research. Now, again, I don't know your research and this is not my domain area, but like, if you're talking to men of a certain age, and Steve, you're a man of a certain age, it is obviously, and
not that old.
No, but I mean, like, if I was talking to you about football, I'm 45 years of age, if you were talking to me about running around a football pitch, I'd be honest with you, I'd probably have a lot more empathy with you than a 25-year-old who's like a whippet, and like, I'm crap at soccer. Do you know what I mean? And again, Nicola, I'd imagine if you were talking to a man or a woman of a certain age who hasn't necessarily been active or is keen to get active, you're more likely to have that kind of connection possibly with somebody. And is that actually one of the things about implementation science? I've heard this mentioned a few times and I'm not exactly sure what it is.
Well, I'm not going to go and give a big spiel about it because I'm still learning about it myself, but it's essentially it's real life. So you can do an intervention or a trial, say, in the lab, and everything works out great. And then you try and bring it in to real life, and things happen. It's windy. It's whatever the trial is, or whatever the initiative is, intervention, and then it doesn't go to plan, because real life never goes to plan, according to plan. So implementation science is basically testing things and looking at things in real life. It's not taking it outside of real life. You're taking all the variables, all the factors, and looking at them in real life, so that you have a better chance of the intervention or initiative sticking, working, because you've tested it in a real life situation.
Okay, so this is like, it's not a clinical setting. You can test something in a clinical setting, and yes, when all the variables are under control, blah blah blah, this is the effect. But actually, when you go out into, you know, the environment, it's totally different kettle of fish.
Because
I understand that. Again, it's like things like, why does anyone smoke? Everyone knows smoking is bad for your health. Mm-hmm. So, you know, logic would state nobody should smoke, but that's not real life,
exactly.
You know, or drink, or insert whatever your poison of choice is here. Yeah, okay, I get what you're talking about there. And again, do you feel that life experience that you're bringing to this research is a positive?
Yeah, I think... I'm not an extrovert. I am quite introverted, but I do enjoy talking to people, and I do enjoy hearing their stories. And I think you have to have a level of empathy, and you have to be able to connect with people. And like, as Steve was saying, he's obviously dealing with men, say, between 30 and 60, and he is in that range. I'm going to be dealing with people of all ages, from 18 to 99,
okay.
Male and female, and everything in between. So it's I have to try and find a way to connect to people who aren't like me, as well as people who are like me, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. But you're clearly a warm person. I mean, you are. I mean, you say you're not an extrovert, but you're obviously friendly.
You're
not standoffish or anything.
No,
like that.
No, I'm a friendly person. I think your life experience comes into play as well, though, because when you're younger, you're worried about making a mistake. You're worried about looking like an idiot. You're worried about not being cool. You're worried about, you know, all those things that once you get into your 30s and early 40s, you really don't care.
Yeah.
You really don't care. You'll ask a stupid question. You'll go up to someone. And actually, I had a supervisor meeting just before I came to chat to you. I was at that conference on Saturday, and like, that was a room of 400 people. I did not know a single person in that room, and yet I came away with contacts for over 20 clubs. I had great chats with people. I even got tips about, you know, going to Centre Parks in Longford from a lady I was talking to. I mean, so you will always find something to bond with someone and have a conversation with, as long as you put yourself out there. And I think it's not about what you've got to say. It's about you listening to that person. And then you can think, OK, I can connect with them on that, or I know where they're coming from on that. And that's where life experience is invaluable, I think, because you've met so many different people throughout your life. I've done a lot of different jobs. I've lived in a lot of different countries. Yeah. I can bring all that experience, which on paper is not academic experience, but I can bring all that to my research and to connecting with other people, you know.
But it's clearly you've built up a skill set. Both of you have built up a skill set over the years that you're able to apply in this new context, which I do think is very, very interesting, because it kind of shows you that not everyone has to go on a certain set path of leave insert, college, da-da-da-da-da-da. It doesn't necessarily work like that. There's a route for everyone if they want it or if they're interested. You know, because I'm only reflecting on my own situation at the moment, because, I mean, as I said, I'm 45 years of age now. I have a master's degree, and I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it, and I didn't really like the subject area, but I managed to put myself over the line with respect to the research master's. And I remember at the time, so this is 20 years ago, I had an opportunity to do a PhD, and I didn't want to do it because I couldn't see myself doing it. I didn't like the area, and I just kind of left that alone. But I'm doing it now, or I'm in the process of organising it now, and I don't know if I could have done it 20 years ago. I don't know if I would have had the mental strength or the wherewithal to do that. And I'm tying in a load of different aspects of skills that I've built up over the years, and I suspect that could be repeated elsewhere. I mean, hearing from the two of you, and I suspect that story is out there amongst many, many people. maybe they just need that little nudge or that little push.
And I think when I was thinking about, I didn't think about doing a PhD when I came back. I was like, oh, I'm going to get my qualification and I'm going to go and get a job.
Yeah.
And I did a placement in third year with Professor Niamh Murphy. It was a research placement, and she was the one that kind of said to me, have you thought about doing a PhD? And I said to her, I think I'm too old. Yeah. And she was having none of it. And she was like, you're well able for it, Nicola.
Yeah.
And I still doubt whether I am able for it, even though I'm in the middle of, I'm good at the start of it, but, you know, imposter syndrome and things like that. But somebody said to me, it's not really about your smarts. Like, yes, there's a level of academic in achievement that you have to have. It's not really about that. It's about your determination. It's about your stubbornness to see a 4-year project through. Mm. And it's your relationship with your supervisors. And if you have the determination and you're a little bit stubborn and you have really good supervisors, then you'll get through it, you know. And it can be an enjoyable experience. Like any job, there's parts that I'm sure I won't enjoy. But overall, an enjoyable experience because you have that kind of set and you have those good relationships and you have that determination. So, you know, if you want it, you go for it.
Mm. Okay. Last question. Have you any advice for aspiring researchers? I know you've just given it. If you want to go for it, but any, like, even just one thing that you've noticed so far or two things that you've noticed so far, is it, oh, this is useful or avoid this. Any sort of advice for aspiring researchers? Steve, we'll start with yourself.
Yeah, I suppose I'd be echoing very much what Nicola said there. It, to me, it's nothing about smarts. I don't consider myself smart, but I would consider myself dogged. And I outlasted so many of my peers as an undergrad. I turned up for classes. I hadn't a clue what was going on. I put my hand up and said, sorry, can you help me? I don't understand. What bit? The bit after the introduction.
I'll be honest with you. Asking that question, that's what's smart. Yeah. I think it is. I mean, there's the old thing about 99% perspiration, or 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration.
Yeah.
I genuinely think that's true.
It's not about the smart, it's about turn up. I suppose the advice is if you are planning to do any kind of postgrad, you're asking yourself, why do you want to do this?
Yeah.
You know, it seems like a good idea at the time. And usually as a mature student, you know why. Because I want to get a career in this, I want to upskill, I've interested in this. Another question to be asking yourself is, who are you working with, who are you collaborating with, and what form does that take? So the supervisors are a huge part. If it's a research master, so whoever your supervisors will be, or PhD research, if it's a taught one, so my master's was applied sport and exercise psychology, and it was a bit like a degree, but the people that were doing it were really, really good. And the same for the PhD. So I was interested in the project, but I did a bit of due diligence on the supervisors and I heard nothing but good things about them. And look, that's been the case with everyone in SETU, in fairness.
Yeah, it's not true for everyone. Don't worry about it.
But I suppose the advice is what I'd offer, and I often come back to this when I'm talking with mature students groups, is speak about it to the people who are, I suppose, your nearest and dearest, your significant others. I couldn't do this without the support of my wife.
Yeah.
There would be no way. She has been so patient and so willing to kind of, I want to sacrifice her needs and wants, but to kind of allow me the scope that I need. So when I came back as an undergrad, it was a full-time job, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5.
Yeah.
That had to be the case. For the master's, it was one day a week, but I had to take a part-time job to support myself. So my wife was able to work shifts around that. And we did this, like, it's not just I determined it, we'd agree this, but I needed her support, because if she wasn't on board, it wouldn't be feasible to do it. And I suppose my kids were young, but I'm doing it for them in a kind of a way as well, to show them that, look, here's something that's available for you. I can remember when I did my very first exam as an undergrad, and I was studying two or three days before, and one of my kids said to me, he just started junior infant, so he wasn't reading and writing, but he was very interested in the whole thing. And he looked at the books, and he looked at the tables, and he looked at the diagrams, and he was looking at my screen. And I said, well, what are you doing, Dad? I said, I'm studying for my exam. And he was really thoughtful, and he didn't say that. And then he said, I think you're going to do really well, Dad. You're trying so hard. And I mean, even now saying that, now I get the goosebumps up my back. And it was that affirmation from him, felt, you know what, no matter what happens, I'm not going to fail, because he can see that I'm trying so hard. Yeah. And I try and keep that with me the whole time. But if you've got kids and you're planning, oh, well, it wouldn't be fair on the kids, well, maybe ask him. if you're planning on going back and thinking, well, it wouldn't be fair on my family, or should we couldn't do this, we couldn't afford it, do a budget. You know, conduct that kind of research, that initial primary research, and see what the feeling is. And I'd encourage anyone to go for it. It really was. I'm not overselling it when I'm saying it literally changed my life and my outlook. The people I met here and the confidence it gave me. I say at 42, I thought my life was over. I genuinely thought I was just going to be going from dead end job to dead end job and just shuffle off. But I felt it's only a beginning. And now I'm 50 next month. And I still say to myself, I wonder what I'll be when I grow up.
Yeah. Brilliant. Have you any advice for aspiring researchers?
Well, a lot of what Steve has said there. But yeah, I think the main thing is that you need to get your family on board. They are going to have to make sacrifices, whether it's time with you, financial sacrifices, even just the fact that you're stressed trying to get an essay in or deadline or whatever. There are definitely sacrifices, so they need to be completely 100% behind you. If you're an undergrad and you're listening and you're thinking, oh, I might like to do research, volunteer, get experience. Your lecturers will always have projects on. They don't just teach you, they do research, and they're extremely busy, but they are more than happy. If you're a student that works hard, they will help you and they will give you opportunities. Take those opportunities. That's how I got into my PhD, because I took the opportunities that were offered to me. And I think, yeah, just similar to Steve, what is your why? Like, what inspires you? What makes you feel alive? Focus on that area if you're looking at postgrad. I mean, you're not going to love every single thing about research integrity or things like that. You know, there are necessary things you have to do. There has to be something in your project that you're passionate about. You know, for me, I'm working on a project that hopefully will improve people's lives. It's about improving the social connection as well as the physical activity. And that's something that I'm very passionate about throughout my whole undergrad. So that's what keeps me, that I know that that's what will keep me going in the difficult times when I'm up to my eyes trying to write my chapters or whatever I'm doing. That's my passion. That'll keep me going. And yeah, count the cost, because there are sacrifices. There will have to be costs. But if I can do it, anybody can do it. Like, you're braver, you're smarter, you're more talented than you think you are. And when you come back to university, you're surrounded by really inspiring people. Like in the Department of Exercise, Sport and Exercise Health Science, they are such a lovely bunch of lecturers. They are so friendly and welcoming, and they really mentor you. And they're amazing. They have a belief in you that maybe you don't actually have yourself, but you kind of start to believe it as you go through all the things that you have to do. And then you do get this level of confidence that is amazing. And I still pinch myself sometimes and think, how on earth am I doing this? But like, they believed in me, so I believe in me. And, you know, you can definitely do it if you want it enough.
Excellent. If somebody wanted to find out more about the kind of work that you're doing or the projects, what's the best place to go? So, Nicola, I suppose follow the Ireland Lights Up work, would it be?
Yeah, you can follow. Well, I think it's on gaa.ie on Twitter and things like that. You can come and you can email me, nicola.briggs@postgrad.wit.ie.
You hopefully have a new address.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. It's a bit confusing having two different addresses.
Yeah.
Or I'm floating around the library top floor, and I'm over in the health sciences building. I've got very long curly hair, you'll probably recognise me.
And Steve, yourself, somebody wants to find out more about the football co-op and the work that you're doing.
Football co-op themselves are on Facebook, but you can catch me on Twitter at Daily Sports Psych, or steve.daly@postgrad.wit.ie.
Oh, yeah, hopefully you'll have a new address soon.
But again, similar, look, I'm in the library, you'll see me around campus. I have a lovely brown corduroy jacket with suede leather patches, so yeah. I mean, if I'm going to act like a lecturer and a PhD, I need to dress like one. So you may also have recognised my poster from when I was involved in the Students' Union. I had a moustache in that, but I haven't changed too much. So look, you'll see me on campus the whole time. I'm the guy going around as if he has doesn't care in the world.
Excellent. Thanks very much for speaking to us today, folks. You've been brilliant. I look forward to hearing how you get on with your work over the next while. If you want to follow this podcast, we are on Twitter or X or whatever it's called. I'll be honest with you, I'm trying for my own mental health, I'm trying not to look at that too much now, because it's just turned into a cesspool of hate. But we are at 9plus podcast on Twitter/X, or you can just look me up on the SCTU website. Rob O'Connor is my name. Folks, thank you very, very much.
Thank you,
Rob.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 9plus. There's a few links to relevant websites in the show notes if you'd like to follow up on what we discussed. And we'll have another episode coming soon.